You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting show of Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Susan Giddings. Susan, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Weather's
starting to get a little fun here in Ohio. Leaves are changing. Some of the mornings are kind of cool. A lot of fun.
We just go from summer to freezing
to summer.
Here. So no.
Yeah, Texas
changing.
Is like summer and hail season.
Yeah,
and that's about it. Hail and tornadoes in summer.
Yeah.
So
yeah. Some acorns falling, but that's it. But
there you go.
All we get. Well, today's topic is a topic that we haven't talked about in depth on the show.
We haven't.
It's a topic that comes up a lot in our phone calls, and to some degree, it comes up in the Facebook group. So today, folks, we're going to talk about...
It goes in phases. Like, we'll get... Phases. Last week or so, we've had quite a few questions.
Yes. Yes, we have. And so we want to talk about the designation process, folks, the designation and designations. Are we going to talk about transfers or are we just going to talk about designations?
I thought a little bit of both. I thought we could also hit on you know, what the you know, a lot of folks think that FSA made this huge change to designations and redesignations. And in fact, that was one of the issues. Is I thought the Bureau was supposed to put people close to home.
500 miles.
Mm-hmm. 500 miles. And so I thought that'd be a good place to start is what's in the FSA and what isn't in the FSA. So as always, I have printed.
Notes.
No, this is right from the statute. I love to cite documents. Mm-hmm. So this is from 3621B.
Title 18.
3621 is releasing. 3624 is designation.
Hopefully. There you go. Caught me swinging.
Hopefully I didn't screw that one up.
No,
so this is the section of law that gives the authority to the Bureau to designate and redesignate folks to institutions. Interestingly enough, this is the same statute that gives that authority to designate to halfway house. That when we talk about the infamous five-factor review, that's in this section. But what's also in here is both the change related to FSA, and then the existing language. So I thought we'd kind of touch on that for a second. So this statute says, ready? The Bureau shall designate the place of prisoner's imprisonment and shall, here's all the caveats, subject to bed availability, prisoner security designation, prisoner's programmatic needs, prisoner's mental and medical health needs, any requests made by the prisoner related to faith-based needs, recommendations of the sentencing courts, and any other security concern of the Bureau of Prisons. That's a whole lot of caveats. Then it says, okay, subject to all of that, the Bureau places the prisoner in a facility as close as practical to the prisoner's primary residence and to the extent practical, in a facility within 500 driving miles of that residence. So if I have lost count, that is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 caveats in one sentence. That is a beautiful thing. That's how statutes work. They put a whole bunch of stuff in there. And if you don't sit down and read it really closely, you're going to miss stuff. This was actually one of the things I did when I was still working with proposed legislation, is we would get proposed legislation and we would have to read it through and really dissect what could this mean if it's passed? You got to look at statute very closely, because they did put a ton of caveats in here. Now, what was new? What was important? Okay, driving miles. The Bureau used to use zip code. So from your release resident zip code, the zip code of the institution, that was as the crow flies definition. So one of the things they took into account was driving directions. And that's important, because anyone who's ever gone anywhere, when you've got to go down 10 miles to get across the bridge to come 10 miles back, or if, you know, depending on the parts of the country where, you know, either they're way open, think West Texas, where they may just have one highway that goes and that's the only option. And then you're working your way through smaller sub roads to get to places. So they eliminated that as the crow flies standard. The other thing, and more important from my perspective, is with regard to redesignations. It says, shall subject to consideration factor described above, a prisoner's preference for staying at his or her current facility or being transferred, transfer prisoners to facilities that are closer than the prisoner's primary residence, even if the prisoner is already in a facility within 500 driving miles of the residence. So prior to the passage of the First Step Act, once you got within 500 miles, and I mean 499, you didn't move closer unless you were changing security levels. We called that a near release transfer. You had to have 18 months clear conduct at your designated facility and be over 500 miles from home. So again, you'd get somebody and they were, and again, this was as the crow flies. So first, like I said, the first change was to first part of the change was driving miles. But then that second part was, you know what, if there is a closer facility, they can move closer. That was a huge deal, because let's face it, you could have several institutions that are within 500 miles, mm-hmm. but the closest institution or a closer institution, you know, it may be a move that only moves a person an hour or two closer. That's permissible under the First Step Act now. What we would call near release transfer. So you're going to the same level facility, camp to camp, low to low. You still have to have the 18 months at your designated facility before they're going to consider a move. But if the initial designation was, it was inside 500 miles, but it's not the closest institution. You're from Pittsburgh and they put you in Petersburg. Petersburg to Pittsburgh is within 500 miles. But so is Cumberland, so is Hazleton, so is Loretto. Those are all closer facilities. So is Elkton. So those are all closer than Pittsburgh, as an example. So that's what the First Step Act did. It did nothing else. What it did was important, but it didn't do anything to say the Bureau has to. We see this all the time on the Facebook group. My loved one got recommended for this and they're on the other side of the country, or they're halfway across the country. So when we talk about judicial recommendations, and we hear a lot and see it on the page, oh, got to get a judicial recommendation for an RDAP program. And we say judicial recommendations aren't really written paper they're written on. Yes, if there is a judicial recommendation and the facts of the PSR and the judgment back it up, and the space is available, will the Bureau honor a judicial recommendation? Yeah. But again, there's a whole lot of if this, if this, if this, if this. So an RDAP recommendation, while nice and makes everyone feel good, if the PSR does not support enrollment in the drug program, in the residential drug program, the judicial recommendation doesn't make a difference. That information is also in this same section of statutes, a little bit further down. Any order, recommendation, or request by the sentencing court that a convicted person serve a term of imprisonment in a community corrections facility shall have no binding effect on the authority of the Bureau under this section to determine or change place of designation. And the place of imprisonment under this subsection is not reviewable by any court. That last line is really interesting. That was also added. The other part about not being binding on the Bureau has been there, but they added that caveat that designations are not reviewable by court as long as they are otherwise, you know, security level, medical, mental health. They're consistent with the agency's security, medical care levels, mental health care levels, all those kind of things. Right. Yeah. So the First Step Act, while it expanded some things, it also really strengthened the Bureau's authority for designation. That's why, you know, when I was still employed, I had real heartburn with some of the things that were coming out of courts related to designation, whether it was institution designations, whether it was halfway house designation. A court has no authority. They can issue an order, but they really don't have the authority to order the Bureau to transfer an individual somewhere. But as I affectionately like to say, the only difference between God and a federal judge is God doesn't think he's a federal judge.
So can people ask for a close home transfer?
Okay. They absolutely can. That's part of the team process, but they need to understand walking in the door and at their first program review, 7 months into their incarceration, asking for a transfer isn't going to happen. I mean, they can ask, but again, they need to be at that institution 18 months for a level to level transfer. And by level, I mean one camp to another camp. So talking about designations, we are talking about, hold it up, 5100.08. It is publicly available. Bruce and I wrote a book on understanding the designation and custody classification process. I will say, and we've seen it firsthand, most lawyers don't necessarily understand the ins and outs of the classification manual. They are also in that pre-trial phase, or I'm sorry, not pre-trial, in the pre-sentencing phase, when the PSR is in draft, they aren't necessarily looking at, their focus is on the sentencing guidelines, the criminal history points, deductions, enhancements, et cetera, related to sentencing. They are not necessarily looking at the content of the PSR beyond the criminal history points. They're not looking at it as the Bureau does. And we've had more than one case in recent days where the individual thought they had one thing coming. And because of the way the PSR was written, they were being upscored. You know, we made some recommendations. Fortunately, they were talking to us while the PSR was in draft. So we were able to make some recommendations about appropriately documenting information from pending charges to verifying education status and all of those kind of things. Things that, like I said, the attorneys aren't thinking about.
Yeah. Yeah. And this, yeah, that was an interesting case, you know, sometimes, but we look at that and where they're going to designate them. I've never seen somebody who was thinking low, it might end up being a medium. You know what I mean? It's just like, holy cow, because the way things are written in the pre-sentence report. And so
absolutely.
They hired us to check that out. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Well, and we've seen some really egregious errors in the PSR. But when talking about the worst one was the individual that was a U.S. citizen and it had conflicting information regarding citizenship. That was fortunately we were able to
jump on
rattle that. A few chains to get that fixed resolved, but it had an impact. So talking about designations, when folks are initially designated, they go to court, they're sentenced. There's a judgment and commitment order. The pre-SR, of course, is done at that point. There's also a document called the Statement of Reasons, which is technically part of or an extension of the judgment and commitment order. But those documents are first released from probation, picked up by the U.S. Marshals. The U.S. Marshals then send that paperwork electronically to the Bureau with a request to designate. The Bureau has that information. They also have, that's the information they have. That information, those three documents, and the information on the Statement of Reasons is important when there are contested issues and it's settled at sentencing by the judge. And rather than having an addendum or an amended PSR, the judge will make a statement regarding perhaps an amount of drugs, perhaps an amount of monetary loss that the person is being held accountable to, or certain paragraphs being thrown out of the PSR. That information is documented on the Statement of Reasons. So they take the PSR, they review, the Bureau takes the PSR, they review the addendum, they review if there's an amended PSR, if there's anything on the SOR to tell them, hey, ignore this or that. They take all of that information and they push it into a scoring matrix where comes up with their base score. One of the things that people really don't understand, and I've seen this actually in the last week, we've probably seen it two or three times, is the idea of what you're pleading to versus what's in your PSR. We call that in the Bureau offense conduct. They are looking at the offense conduct section and are documenting the most serious. They are scoring the most serious documented behavior. So if you pled to just drugs, but there is information regarding serious bodily injury or death, brandishing a firearm, those kind of things which talk about the threat, you will end up with not a score based on the amount of drugs, but a score that also includes this threat of serious bodily injury or death. We see it a lot in smuggling cases, immigration smuggling cases. The immigration statutes, they're scored out. But when there's documented behavior that, for instance, individuals were left in a box truck and the vehicle was abandoned because law enforcement was in pursuit, moving people in a box truck across the Southwest U.S. is extraordinarily dangerous. I've had cases where people were being smuggled by coyotes and they were drugged. So that they were calmer while they were locked inside of a dark box truck. All of those will get you what we call a greatest severity offense score. It puts you right to the top because of the threat to loss of life. Even if no one died, no one has to get hurt or die for that offense level to be elevated. Mm-hmm. And if that happens, you are automatically greatest severity then. You automatically get what's called a public safety factor, and you are not going to a camp, regardless of anything else that's going on, regardless of any other point scoring. That public safety factor elevates your case, and you're not going to a camp. And people need to understand that. Now, in terms of offense conduct, I do have an asterisk. in drug conspiracy cases, if the judge held you, if you were specifically held to a specific amount of drugs within a larger conspiracy, then the Bureau will score the specific amount of drugs. If you weren't held to a specific amount and you have this range, well, it was more than 10 and less than 500, right? You got the whole thing. And then you're scored high, and then, you know, you're scored higher. But that offense conduct, I can't tell you how many times I hear, but I pled to, right. And pleading is a expedient way to move people through the system, but it has nothing to do with the offense conduct from the Bureau's perspective.
So even though we're not talking about classification, but these types of classification situations affect where you're designated to.
100%, because it makes a difference in your points, and then it can create an impact in terms of public safety factors, because public safety mm-hmm. factors change your classification long term. Because once you have a public safety factor, now there are a couple that are time based, but for those that aren't time based, you carry it for your entire sentence, which means you could be locked down a long time. You could be doing all the programming, staying out of trouble, clear conduct, doing all the good stuff, and you will not be eligible to go to minimum security unless you're granted a waiver. And that waiver is recommended by the unit team, signed off by the warden, and has to be approved by DSCC, and not just the field designator, the line designator that's reviewing the case. It is elevated up to the DSCC chief to review, because it's an exception to be granted a waiver. So that's huge. You know, other things that impact designation is medical and mental health history. And sometimes we see folks maybe not being as forthright as they should be, not providing documentation to the probation office, verifying that information. And then when they want to, you know, then they're concerned about self-surrendering with, say, a medical device, but there's nothing in the PSR that even indicates they have a diagnosis even remotely related to the need for this device. So then they show up with something, and the first thing that happens is A, you're separated from your device, and a medical officer, a medical staff member will review your PSR to determine if there's anything that supports you having that. And if there isn't, you're not getting it. So, yeah. You know, it's really important. You know, your attorney is reading your PSR for, you know, like I said, criminal history points, for sentencing guidelines, but you should be reading your own to verify that information. That's a huge thing, because the Bureau does classify institutions not just by security level, but by medical and mental health needs.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, some other kind of fun examples where perhaps older inmates that have the CPAP machine or some other kind of medical issue. And so they'll be talking about these medical issues, but they want to go to a care level one camp because they heard it's a real good camp.
Because it's a real nice camp.
But so if you go to a care level one camp, you're going to be working, and you're not there to receive medical treatment. You're there to be working. And so, yeah, sometimes there's a disconnect.
Or you've got some kind of assisted device, whether it's a brace, whether it's hearing aids, whether you're using a cane or a walker. Some of our institutions have large, more geriatric populations, right. And they've got a lot of folks with medical devices. But if your PSR doesn't even talk about your medical issues, that you've had knee replacement surgery or hip replacement surgery, and you're still receiving PT and are still using a cane to get around or whatever the case is, if that's not in your work, the Bureau does not have your medical records.
And talk about OMD, OMDT, if you could, a little bit.
So OMDT is the Office of Medical Designation and Transfer. They're co-located with the DSCC staff, but they're their own department. So what happens when someone's looking at for designation and, you know, staff are looking at and they're reviewing that medical, they're reviewing everything. Well, they look at that medical stuff. And obviously, if it says you're healthy and wonderful and there's no issues, they keep going. But once they start seeing two and three paragraphs and there's all this stuff and it's what medications and diagnoses and surgeries and stuff, they pass that over, that case, over to the OMDT staff. And OMDT has medical providers, nurses, physicians, people who can read medical words and go, oh, I know what that is. And they have a full, algorithm they use to make assessments. So what happens on initial designation, because again, all they have is what's written, they're making some assessments based on the written content, and they will give folks what we call a screen assignment. And it will be screen one through screen four. And they will designate based on that information. And then when the person gets to the institution, that screening level is a flag for the institution to expect someone either with realistically healthy and no issues, or has a whole lot of issues and we may, you know, so that flags the case so that when that person arrives and they're going through that intake screening process and they're talking to a medical staff member, the medical staff member is going to be asking additional questions and kind of trying to kind of parse out some information. And do we need to send this person to get labs? What part of in that first 30 days when they're doing that medical intake and the medical assessment, what do we need to do? And then a person goes from a screen assignment to an actual care level assignment. And both medical and mental health care levels is actually relative to the age of the institution. I mean, the age of the agency is actually kind of newer.
Do the screen and the care level match?
Do they what?
Do the screen one and care level one mean the same thing? Screen two, care level two?
So sort of. So screen one means you look like, based on just a paper review, that you're healthy and okay. Then you get to the institution, you're interviewed by a medical provider, and they confirm, based on that interview, the information's the PSR. So yes, you convert. Sometimes you will get a screen two assignment, and then they come in and they interview, and you're like, well, yeah, that was true when my PSR was being written, but, you know, it was 9 months, you know, that was 9 or 10 months ago or 2 years ago. So they go, oh, okay. So now they go, all right, well, maybe they do some tests and maybe they have some blood work done or something like that. So you might be a care two, but you might drop down to a care one, or maybe your health has deteriorated since that PSR was written. You know, for a lot of folks, the gap between the PSR being finalized and come into prison is not a huge gap, but when there a lot of time goes by, that information can become stale and outdated, and in both directions, your health could be worse, your health could be better. So that's why, you know, this is the screening process is literally just paper documents, right? And it's just the documents you have. They don't have your medical records. So, but
they have what's written in the precedence report. And so,
and just because say that you need to have something or that, or you're doing this or that, that's not verified. As I like to say, individuals report, family can concur, but doctors verify.
Okay. Yeah.
So having information from your physician that is provided to the probation officer is a really good decision.
It is.
So some other issues that impact designation is history issues, namely history of escape and history of violence. Now, this came up, saw this week as well.
Failure to appear, yeah, to appear. And
oh, others. Well, yeah, on the escape side. But I was going to talk about the violence first.
Okay.
I have seen just this week, saw a question regarding history of violence. But the person who was asking the question said he was 16 years old. If it is in the PSR, it counts. That means a juvenile conviction, a juvenile adjudication that wasn't sealed and is put in the PSR, a juvenile arrest that you were tried as an adult. Go on, Bruce. You want to ask a question?
No. Even if it was 20, 30, 40 years ago.
100%. It gets older. Yeah. It gets older, but it's never gone. So it could have happened literally 25 years ago. It is still part of your record. It's only worth a point or two in terms of designation. But that point or two, you know, a serious history of violence more than 15 years ago, right, is still worth a couple of points. But if we couple that with age, criminal history score, offense conduct, it starts to add up. Something else that came up was the idea of, with history of escape and violence, is the Bureau doesn't like score each one and then add them together. They look at any incident and then they score the most serious. So you might start off as being scored with serious history of violence recent, less than 5 years, and then it goes to 5 to 10 years. And so it goes from 7 points to 6 points.
Right.
Well, the next step down for serious history of violence over 10 years drops to 4 points. But if you got an incident report within the last 5 years, that's worth 5 points. That's a minor history of violence. So it's not necessarily that they'll look at the same thing. Looked at a case. We looked at a case a couple weeks ago, and I, as a general rule, will err to the conservative. And by that, I mean, I will score to whatever is worse. And the person we were looking at, I was like, well, if they look at this one and they consider it to be serious violence, you're going to have 7 points. If they don't, well, then they're going to look at this one that's older because it's worth 6 points, even though there's a recent one that's worth 5 points. And, but they might score it. I would score it. And that's what my conversation was. I would score it as a 7 point history of violence.
See, so there is some human error and subjectivity.
100%.
At the DSCC. And so I remember that case well. And you're like, hey, man.
It could go this way or it could go that way.
Mr. A, remember, I think, or something went by him and then he got what he wanted. But yeah, we had a guy. And
It was an old, he had a really old case. Right. And I was like, it's old enough. It's not going to make a difference.
And he was
stressing about it because again, in us writing up our review of the PSR, you know, I was like, hey, just so you know,
it's there.
And I'm just letting you know.
Don't know how they're going to score it, but it's there. So yeah,
they shouldn't get all wigged out about it, but you know, depending on who's looking at it, they could. So he was stressing a bit and I felt bad for stressing him out, but I think it's better when it comes to this kind of issue. I think it's better to know what are those worst case scenarios, you know, what are you looking at potentially and why and understanding why. But yeah, so history of escape, history of violence. Interesting thing on history of violence, serious or minor, the definition the Bureau uses when scoring for designation is threatening or intimidating behavior, which is likely or not likely to cause serious bodily injury or death. It doesn't say actual injury had to occur. It's just threatened or intimidating behavior.
Could result.
Right. So you don't actually have to have injured someone if the behavior was such that people could have. Right. See it all the time looking at history items where someone decides that they're not going to get pulled over and they go on a high-speed chase through a residential neighborhood, knock over trash cans, crash through someone's fence, and end in a front yard. I use that as an example because that's a real case.
Oh, yeah,
from several years ago, not one of ours. And that kind of, you know, and of course the actual conviction was evading blue light and I'm drawing a blank now on the traffic, reckless operation, and there was something else. He got scored with serious history of violence for that, because that was aggressive behavior that could have resulted in serious bodily injury or death. Fortunately, no one did, and the only thing he killed was a trash can and a fence. But it could have been a heck of a lot worse. So that's why those are scored that way.
And I'm so glad you bring that up, because that just, again, has ramifications on the designation of where somebody's
absolutely
going.
Going back to the importance of an accurate PSR, if that conviction was later expunged and it's removed from your record, why is it in a PSR? In a PSR? If a juvenile record was sealed, why is there a reference to it in a PSR? Because the Bureau, I am not a lawyer, nor do I play one on TV, but if I see a PSR that has that kind of content, asking that question, you know, and we have seen that happen. Why was it left in the PSR?
Yeah.
And again, an attorney may not realize, you know, again, they're only looking at that criminal history point. Well, there's no points assessed.
And if we get hired too late after the cement has dried on the revisions, that's a wrap. It's in there. That's it. And it's not. I mean, I guess you could.
For clients in those situations is we're talking to them about what documentation do you have? Yeah. What documentation? And with that documentation, you know, working with them to provide that information to their case manager to request that it's got to be verified again, regardless of where it comes from. The Bureau will verify, we'll have to contact the agency to verify, you know, the court order for expungement or the sealing of the record. And, you know, but then you're fighting, you're in the uphill.
And some of these things are old. The family member has to chase them down. The lawyer isn't interested necessarily in chasing it down.
It could be an old case. It could be years old. And the records may be very difficult to come by.
Right.
And then it just creates a significant hurdle. And yes, you can fight it. You can file an administrative remedy. But you're still sitting in a more secure facility. Yeah. You know? So, and then there are cases that are just weird and they don't, you know, most cases kind of fall into, in terms of scoring, will fall into certain patterns, and case managers know what to look for in terms of dismissals and conduct and things like that. And then you'll just get something that's weird, and the way it's annotated doesn't make sense. Those are the ones that, you know, hopefully we're catching them in draft to go back to, so that the lawyer can go back to probation and say, what is this? You know, looked at a case just recently that referred to a violation, and all it said was federal district court. What district? Right. Like, if it was okay, but what district? You know, like, you know what district you were sentenced in. If it was a federal district court, there should be, you know, it was the Eastern District of Tennessee or the Northern District of Ohio or whatever the case is. And even if it is legitimately open, and needs to be resolved, why is there that? Because the Bureau can't do their job if there's, what about the jurisdiction? What about the case number? All of those things are important in the PSR, but they will affect your designation. Now, let's talk about unresolved pending charges and open cases. The Bureau will score any open charge as a possible detainer, even if it's not a real detainer. If the PSR suggests that it's open, that it hasn't been resolved, it hasn't been closed, you know, a probation violation that hasn't been discharged and resolved, a pending charge on anything, they will score those. With the exception of traffic stuff, they won't score traffic tickets. But if you get a failure to appear and it was more than just a traffic, you know, a basic traffic, it was maybe eluding arrest. And we start to get more closer to what felonies look like. And then you throw a failure to appear on it and it gets bigger and uglier, but those are scored. And then whatever that conduct involved is scored just like they score the instant offense. So you end up with getting bumped for 7 points up to greatest severity. And then you've got this unresolved thing from 15 years ago that looks like it's violent. And so they give you a 7-point detainer. Now, before they've done anything else, you're at 14 points. You're not in a camp anymore. And you're only 2 points from being in a medium security facility.
Damn.
And it happens that easily. So I know we are running out of time and we're not really going to be talking too much about redesignation, but really quickly, we talked about what near release transfer is. Also want to talk about program transfers. A lot of folks, times people want to be able to get into a specific program. For program transfers, the Bureau is looking at those national level programs. The residential drug abuse program, Life Connections, the Skills program, Skills, that's a mental health program, the FIT program for women. Those are national level programs.
Sex offender, the
sex offender treatment programs, both residential and non-residential, because they're not offered everywhere. Those are national level programs. Those are the programs that you can request a program transfer for. Wanting to go to an institution because they have a dog program. Yeah. I mean, that's nice, but that's not going to get you a program transfer. And before FSA and the lifting of the 500-mile barrier, you know, a lot of times people would try to hunt for a program that was available at an institution that was closer to home, so then they could go and request a program transfer. And that's not how it works. But that's one of the programs. There is also, obviously, if someone gets in trouble, they can get a greater security transfer and move up in security level, or they can work their way down and get a lesser security transfer. Lesser security transfers are great because, and we did do this with FS before FSA, is you'd bring them down and closer to home at the same time.
So, but isn't it, okay, let's talk about that just for one. Oh, we don't have enough time. We got 7 minutes. But if I'm at a complex and I'm at the medium and I qualify for a less security transfer, but there's a low at my complex.
Yes.
Is it going to be easier just to send me to the low at my own complex versus?
Well, it used to be. And there was a change right before, was it right before or right after? I can't remember right now. I retired. There was a thing called intercomplex transfers, where a warden
didn't have to go through DSCC. That's right.
Right. So where a warden, it didn't have to go through DSCC. If it was just a simple lesser security transfer, the warden could sign off and move that. Right before, right after I transferred, they eliminated, at least in the short term. I don't know if it's a long-term thing, but they did eliminate they didn't eliminate intercomplex transfers. They eliminated the warden's ability to do it himself. So whether you were moving just across the street to a low, or across the country to a low, they all had to go to DSCC.
I guess some mistakes were made.
Possibly. I feel like it's kind of inefficient to send a referral all the way to Texas to move a dude across the street, but I'm not in charge of anything. That's why I retired. Yes, you can stay within the complex. If there's space and it's appropriate and it's close to home, you know, and obviously that is also the least costly.
And if you go camp to camp, you can furlough transfer.
Yes. You can also furlough transfer from a low to a camp. Ooh. Because you've achieved minimum security and they're putting you in a camp. So if you're going from camp to camp or low to a camp, you can go by furlough. And a furlough is the Bureau buys you a bus ticket, takes you to the bus station, and you go by Greyhound to get yourself to your new institution. Of course, sometimes folks get themselves in trouble with that. And we'll just say, you know, follow the rules. You got yourself to a camp. You got yourself to the camp you want to get to. Blowing it by screwing up a furlough is you know, never a good decision. So
not good. No.
Kind of comical.
So yeah,
it happens.
That is an option. The furlough transfer mm-hmm. is an option for some folks in that low security.
Absolutely.
Low security category. So that's really good. Saves the government money.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win for everybody. So that's awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah. So those are the big types of transfers. There are some other ones, if an individual's having problems on their yard, either because they created some problems, for example, running up gambling debts and then not paying them off is a great way to get yourself put in special housing and then move somewhere else. And then there are circumstances that are not within the person's control.
Disciplinary transfers. Talk about those real quick. Disciplinary transfer?
They don't actually use the disciplinary transfer code anymore. It's not a code anymore. But they look at you from your security level. So you could still get moved. You could still be in a greater security transfer,
right.
With or without a management variable. They're just not using that code.
Sorry, I digress. Yes.
Yeah. Greater. No, that was. But it's not a really old change. It's just a change.
Yeah,
I think maybe there was a little too much sanctioning a disciplinary transfer, or perhaps disciplinary officers maybe being, pressed to, transfer the person so that the warden can get them off their yard. Who knows?
We're at a minute and a half.
Well, you want to talk about our books?
Okay. Yeah, we got
our books. We did talk about our green book. Huh?
Green book, so
we have Unlocking Federal Time Credits, the Blue Book, second edition. It's available on Amazon. When you search for it, please include second edition. And then the Green Book is Unlocking Prison Designation and Custody Classification. We actually go through the entire custody manual. We discuss every single way everything is scored. We also have a really huge section talking about the impact of the PSR. And not just on designations, but on everything from program eligibility to even getting your visiting list processed quickly. We cover all kinds of things there. So they're both really good resources available on Amazon. Not that expensive. I think both of them are $16.99, I think.
Yeah, cheap. Can mail them to your loved one in the institution.
They can be mailed. They are published via Kindle, and that is consistent with policy because that is a book publisher.
There you go.
So,
good. There it is. Another fantastic and informative program for you today on designations. And be with us next week for another exciting program. Don't forget to go by our Facebook group, First Step Act Early Release from Federal Prison, our First Step Act YouTube channel. We're on Apple Podcast, but we're also on LA Talk Radio. All of our shows are archived, and you can listen or view them and download them for free and directly from LA Talk Radio. So what a blessing that is. All right, everybody. Well, until next time, have a safe and blessed week, and we'll see you here next time on Around the Block. Take care,
buddy.
Bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.